Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Matt Gubins from the University of California at San Francisco, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This is one of my patients, 79-year-old gentleman, pretty heavy smoker before, who had stage 1B cancer, had it resected, and 2 years later on surveillance, he was found to have pleural metastatic disease, so pleural nodules, some pleural fluid. We gave him carbo and pemetrexed for 2 cycles, progressed right through it. Nevo had just come on board, nivolumab, so we started Nevo at that point, 15 doses, fantastic response, probably 80% reduction in the nodules, the fluid stayed away. But then kind of between surveillance scans, he had really rapid onset of exertional dyspnea. He called and said, I can't even make it to the shower. So we brought him into clinic. His O2 in clinic was about 91%. And so, of course, we got stat imaging that day and very clear pneumonitis, classic, every lobe involved, a very clear pattern. So we stopped nivolumab. We started steroids, kind of had a debate about whether to admit him to the hospital, but he didn't need supplemental oxygen. He was at 91%. He had good follow-up. So we just started steroids at about 1 mg/kg. And within a couple of weeks, he had very clear improvement in the symptoms. And, you know, over the course of about 2 or 3 months, we had a very gradual taper, saw resolution on imaging. And then it's always that question, do you re-challenge? Do you stay off drug? We chose to keep him off and just watch him closely. He got scans every 6 to 8 weeks. Unfortunately, after about 6 months of treatment holiday, he had very clear progression newly in the liver. At that point, I had a long conversation about the risks and benefits of maybe re-challenging. You know, he hadn't failed Nevo, it was just the toxicity. Now, in the interim, atezolizumab had come on board, so it kind of offered 2, at least theoretical benefits. One was a logistical benefit, every 3 weeks instead of every 2 weeks. That's nice for a patient who lives far away. And also this kind of maybe more theoretical one that maybe, just maybe, the PD-L1 inhibitors may have a titch less toxicity. I'm not solely convinced about that, but I do think it was a reasonable thing to say, hey, it's worth it, a try to different agent. And we had a long conversation that the recidivism rate's real, kind of estimated maybe a 50% chance we'd see pneumonitis, but figuring that even though that's a risky proposition, if we're very much on it, we hear any change in symptoms, we could certainly stop and readdress. And he actually tolerated it beautifully, but right after 3 doses, after 9 weeks, he had further progression in the liver. And so, unfortunately, had to switch over to chemo, which he did not respond well to, just as he hadn't in the first place. And we put him on hospice and, unfortunately, kind of were not able to get him any more treatment.
How long has he been on hospice now?
This is fairly recent. He's been on about 2 months. He's kind of had slow but steady decline in his performance status. Not especially dyspneic, actually, but just really the fatigue, malaise, and anorexia that we kind of think is just further progression.
And what's his current state of mind?
He's at peace with it. It's kind of this, all this excitement about immunotherapy that we share with our patients. And he was the one of ones who had just this beautiful response. So he had a lot of hope for that second re-challenge. He wasn't scared of the toxicity. He trusted us to be able to follow him closely and nip it in the bud if it came. But I think it was obviously disappointing to not get that second response.
I want to go back through a few aspects of his case, but just to follow up a little bit in terms of his current situation, I'm going to guess that at some point he had some type of multiplex or NGS testing.
He did. We didn't do it for his original stage 1B disease, but of course on metastatic presentation, we did do NGS. We did detect a KRAS mutation. So we talked a lot about that. We didn't have any active trials in the first line. And by the time he kind of blew through first line, we had nivolumab to offer. And he lives far away from our center. We talked about clinical trials in the immunotherapy space, but just single agent Nevo was available and I think very appropriate for his care.
Going back to your decision to try the atezolizumab, which I thought was really interesting when I saw this case, because the anti-PD-L1 agents came out, you heard this thing about maybe there's going to be less pulmonary toxicity. My understanding is the anti-PD-L1 agents, like atezolizumab, get the ligand for PD-L1, so it doesn't get the ligand for PD-L2. Tell me if my simplified explanation is right.
Yeah, exactly.
But yet the anti-PD-1 agents that hit the receptor, therefore essentially suppressing PD-L1 and 2?
Exactly.
And what was the thinking about why it might have less pulmonary toxicity? And it kind of sounds like you think it really didn't pan out.
Well, I think you have to look at the data we've got in front of us. We're never going to see a head-to-head trial, certainly nowhere in the near future. You know, I think that numerically, there's maybe a couple percentage points difference, but you always have to say cross-trial comparisons are somewhat suspect. I know there was a meta-analysis, again, that amplified that 1% to 2% difference. And again, it's just hard to say when the response rates track so well, when the other immune-related AEs track fairly well across Nivo, Pembro, Atezo. I can't put a lot of stock in it. But I do admit, in this case, where I admit there's a re-challenge risk, and I think some of those recidivism rates look like 50% or so, I'll take any little marginal benefit I can. But yeah, that idea that only hitting the ligand, it's just a much more selective inhibition there and kind of avoids some of the more general effects of the PD-L1, PD-L2 axis.
We'll get into the issue of first-line therapy, but I am curious how you approach the issue of second-line therapy. Right now, typically, that theoretically would be a patient who has a lower PD-L1 assay, so they're not going to get it first line or checkpoint inhibitor first line. They get chemo, maybe they get Bev if they're non-squamous. We should mention this man was an adenocarcinoma.
Right.
But then they progress and second line therapy. How do you go about choosing a checkpoint inhibitor there?
I have a lot of equipoise among the three agents we talked about, Pembro, Nivo, Atezo. Again, I'm not convinced by any real significant efficacy or toxicity differences. So a lot of it really plays into logistics. A lot of our patients are coming from a distance, and absent any clear benefit for one or the other, the three-week dosing sure is easier for patients. I'm a little paternalistic. The occasional patient that I'm nervous about, maybe their performance status is a bit marginal, I still kind of reach for Nivo because I know someone's going to lay eyes on them every 2 weeks. But in general, for a relatively fit, good PS patient, I typically use Atezo or Pembro mostly for logistics. And Pembro, of course, has the PD-L1 requirement of 1% or higher. So if they happen to be a non-expressor, if we don't have the data, Atezo is right available out of the box.
So this 79-year-old man, you say, was a heavy smoker in the past. Did he have chronic lung disease?
He had just a touch of emphysema, didn't have clinical COPD, but had radiographic evidence of emphysema. But, you know, really excellent O2 status and actually good performance status, a dancing and singing when I first met him.
Wow, interesting. So it sounds like in this case, it was sort of straightforward that he had pneumonitis. I'm curious how often you run into this situation specifically with lung cancer when you're really not sure. You know, you've got a patient with prior lung disease, maybe cardiac disease, you have tumor in the lung. Do you find situations where you're really not sure what's going on and have to stop the checkpoint inhibitor?
Most definitely. And I think that, you know, our radiologists have gotten so much savvier about trying to call these differences. I think I've seen lymphangitic disease called so much more frequently in the last 2 years than I have the 10 years prior. So I think it winds up being a discussion, and I'd completely acknowledge that point. This case happened to be fairly standard, or the radiographic appearance was really unimpugnable. But when there's that question of pre-existing interstitial lung disease, whether that's smoking associated or other, or kind of a lymphangitic picture that's hard to discern, or the patients who have had radiation in the past where there's kind of a radiation pneumonitis piece to it, I think it's challenging. So really, as with a lot of these immune-related AEs, I bring in my pulmonologist, I'm talking to my ID docs. And you know, in this case, it was so straightforward, we didn't even admit to the hospital, but I have a very low threshold to bring them in, ask my pulmonologist to do a bronchoscopy. Again, it's not always a satisfying entity, and sometimes just we have to kind of look at it a bit empirically and say, it's risky enough, let's just stop the drug and put them on steroids and kind of see how it plays out.
So obviously there's a lot of individualization involved, but I'm just kind of curious your gestalt. When you start a patient on a PD-1 agent like nivolumab, in this case, in your own mind, putting it all together in terms of data and your own clinical experience, what's your best estimate for the risk of pneumonitis for something like this to happen?
I'd say the kind of the 5% proportion that you kind of see, plus or minus a couple percent, is very consistent with what we've seen in our practice. And again, I think there probably is a mild correlation with previous radiation. We were very involved in one of the clinical trial groups, and they were very conservative to say anyone who had had, let's say, 40 gray of radiation was prohibited from seeing a PD-1 inhibitor within 6 months. In real practice, of course, that's not always practical. Patient may have had chemo rads for stage 3 disease and has a rapid recurrence. When I see that kind of patient, when there's not as much clinical data, I am very honest with the patient. I say, we're going to follow you very closely. There's at least a theoretical risk of some radiation pneumonitis, or maybe pneumonitis that is more likely in the setting of that recent heavy dose of radiation. So it's just, I think it's something to bear in mind.
Well, actually, not to get too far off topic, but I was going to ask you, there's a press release out there about a trial with durvalumab after chemo radiation with locally advanced that supposedly, and I think, did you participate in that study?
I didn't, no, but that's exciting news. The Pacific trial, I'm looking forward to seeing more than a press release.
Right, but there would be the situation you just described. Right. The patient's just gotten radiation. Do we know from that trial or any other similar trials globally kind of what happens when you give a checkpoint inhibitor right after chemo radiation?
Again, I think that just kind of the early data suggests that it probably is safe, and it's just something you have to watch. Yeah, I think that's a really good counterpoint to say, again, the company we worked with was very conservative about that, again, before we knew, but now seeing the Pacific trial, at least in press release form, hinting at no great huge safety signals, that it may well be safer than we thought it was.
It's going to be interesting. Maybe, who knows, that's going to become standard of care in next year or two. It wouldn't be like a total shock, I don't think.
It wouldn't. Though I think the bar in that stage 3 setting is a little different than what we're looking at in metastatic. I think with any adjuvant trial, even in these high-risk stage 3-ish patients, I think we have to be very mindful of, are we just buying some PFS that we would have bought at the metastatic recurrence, or are we actually genuinely buying more cure rate? I think it's an interesting question that we've got to keep in mind as we evaluate these data as they come in.
It also ties into a question I've kind of had, and I'm not really sure exactly what people are doing in their practice, which is, you have a patient who either gets adjuvant therapy or chemo radiation for locally advanced disease and then has a quick relapse. So maybe say within 6 months they've had adjuvant chemo or chemo radiation. When you treat them at that point, do you follow a first line algorithm or a second line?
It depends on how strenuously I treated them in the chemo radiation setting. And I tend not to use, let's say in a non-squamous patient where pemetrexed really is my favored metastatic regimen. For a patient who is getting chemo rads for locally advanced disease, I often actually don't use a pemetrexed-based regimen. So I tend to use carboplatin etoposide or carboplatin paclitaxel. So sometimes I'm more tempted to say, let's give you the best metastatic chemo regimen, has an opportunity for maintenance use. A patient who kind of saw that or really blew through quickly, which suggests they're just really going to be chemo refractory, then I'm more inclined to say that was your first line of chemo and now let's go straight to the immunotherapy approaches. I think it's very case-based and situational, but you know, I think even the difference between 2 months and 6 months makes a difference in my mind in that setting.
Now, this patient had a great response. How quickly was it before clinically you felt he was responding?
Scan number one. And I usually get my scan after 8 or 9 weeks, you know, kind of depending on the cycle length. But he was one of these folks on the spaghetti curves who had a response straight away and sustained that through the course of his nivolumab.
Was he symptomatic and did his symptoms improve?
Well, I think there was an element of dyspnea and there was also kind of a, again, kind of fatigue, malaise, anorexia that improved beautifully, really, even in the first month of treatment.
And is that typically what you see in terms of time to response with checkpoint inhibitors?
I typically see the responses by staging scan number one or two. Very rarely do I see this kind of, I've only seen pseudoprogression once in my entire practice. For all the words spilled on paper about pseudoprogression and lung cancer, I have seen it once. It's kind of a unique patient who had kind of really small pulmonary nodules bilaterally, so I think he was kind of a special case. But really, for the most part, I think my practice, I'm seeing the response straight away.
You brought up the issue of pseudoprogression that comes up in every cancer where checkpoint inhibitors are used. The rule of thumb that, you know, kind of I think we first heard from the melanoma people a few years ago was that if the patient's feeling the same or better and it's an imaging thing, just keep going. Is that the way you do it?
I think that's fair. Again, obviously the devil's in the details, but if patients have very modest increase in the size of their tumors and they're feeling great or even improved, I'll leave them on. But I think the problem is we're so hopeful about these agents. We have to remember, at least as single agents in the second line, our response rate is 20%. So I think some of it winds up being hopeful thinking. So if the patient has any clinical decline or really kind of multiple new nodules that aren't lymph nodes that could be reactive, I really say we should be moving on to the next thing or thinking about a trial at that point.
This man had, he actually had a clinical CR?
No, he had a PR. CCR is very vanishingly rare. I've had one or two in my whole practice, but he probably had about a 60 to 70% reduction.
So he had a very good response. He got 15 treatments. It sounds like he was kind of cruising out into the, you know, good part of the curve that we like to see people on. Again, from your point of view, globally, in a situation like this, second line therapy, for example, what's your global estimate of the risk that the patient's going to have a really useful prolonged response or prolonged stable disease or without having to change therapy?
Yeah, I'd say our experience has been kind of what's been seen in the trials, about 20% authentic response rate with another, let's say, 10% or so of folks who maybe don't meet RECIST criteria for a partial response, but who have meaningful stability in the face of what had been growing tumor. I've definitely had a subset of those.
And one other kind of detail this case I was curious about is I noticed initially when he was treated for metastatic disease, again, adenocarcinoma, he was given carbo-pem. So just a real simple question, how about Bev?
I actually still use bevacizumab in a significant proportion of my patients. I didn't get into it in the case presentation, but he had a, you know, a fairly long history of hypertension requiring a couple of medications to manage. So kind of this phenotype of patient where I'm a little more concerned about the downsides of Bev versus the upsides. For younger, fitter patients who aren't vasculopaths, I do tend to add Bev in that setting. I still believe there's a subset of patients who get real benefit. But this is that patient who I think had enough comorbidities that I figured that the marginal benefit was going to be lower.
So again, getting back to your global take on checkpoint inhibitors and lung cancer, you sort of threw out the figure of 5% for pneumonitis. What other complications do you see with these agents that are the most common? What are the risks? Specifically curious about colitis and endocrine problems.
Well, certainly thyroid dysfunction is very common. I think we probably have low double digits, maybe 10 to 15% in our experience, which I think replicates what we see in the trials. Fortunately, it's something that's common enough and followable enough that we can get thyroid function tests on a regular basis. It's baked into our protocols. And so it's something that we're usually able to identify quickly and handle and usually not have to suspend treatment for. The rarer endocrinopathies, let's say diabetes, we see that a handful of times, definitely 1% or less. You know, some of the other endocrinopathies we see. And I think that we've just become very, very quick when we see any derangement to be sharing these patients with our endocrinologists and kind of trying our best to keep patients on treatment if we can manage symptoms like with hyperhypothyroidism, but otherwise to really manage aggressively. I'd say the other things we're seeing, maybe even more than I expected, rash, sometimes just bothersome, but sometimes actually severe enough that we are sending folks for dermatology referral much more quickly. Fortunately, we have kind of forged really good relationships with our dermatologists in the oncology setting for side effects of other targeted therapies and treatments. So we already have a good relationship, but a lot of folks we are having to refer over for management of rash that can be problematic. I think I've seen more, and this is more of a nuisance issue, but I've seen it more than I think I've heard it reported. I have so many patients who have pruritus, and sometimes just annoying, and we can manage it with diphenhydramine or what have you, but sometimes severe enough, affecting quality of life and sleep enough that we entertain at least the idea of treatment hold. And then the other one that I think has been interesting, a lot of migratory arthralgias and such, sometimes very classic, even kind of swollen joints and discomfort, but often more subjective, saying today my left hip hurts, tomorrow my hands hurt, and we just, you know, kind of follow those over time. And I've made a couple of referrals to rheumatology to help out. Sometimes what I wind up doing or having to do is brief holds or brief pulses of steroid to kind of help address that.
So I'm curious, you would think, I don't know, I thought maybe it was going to be more of a problem, but I don't hear too many cases. Have you had any patients with prior autoimmune disorders who you then wanted to give a checkpoint inhibitor to, and what do you do?
Yeah, that's a tough question. And again, it's an area where I hope we learn more in the real world practice of these drugs, because all those patients appropriately were excluded from the trials. Often, I think you can kind of stratify those patients a couple of ways. Folks who have kind of long histories, but maybe burnt out autoimmune diseases or things that are very good control over years, I'm more comfortable with. Psoriasis, it doesn't require systemic treatment. We've treated several patients in that setting and haven't seen recurrences. What makes me nervous are folks, I didn't get back to your question about colitis. I don't see colitis de novo. I've seen it once or twice. I admit to a lot of nervousness for folks who have baseline ulcerative colitis or some such. And, you know, sometimes the risk-benefit ratio, they're out of other options. We try it with a lot of caution, but those patients are the ones that make me quite nervous.
So let's go on and hear about your second case. I think really gets to the question of the day in lung cancer. Let's hear about your 51-year-old lady.
Yeah, so we have a 51-year-old woman who had metastatic lung adenocarcinoma. She had a big right hilar mass that was actually the source of her symptoms, but on staging had very clear bilateral lung nodules. No other distant sites of disease, though. She'd had a mild smoking history, 10-pack years, a couple decades ago. She actually wound up on one of our trials. She wound up getting on-protocol carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab, the regimen that's now, of course, approved that we'll talk about in a second. But she had an excellent response. She, like our patient before, had a response by scan number one after, I think it was 9 weeks, had 80% reduction in the size of her disease. And so she continued on carbo, pem, and pembrolizumab on protocol, and just had a very good sustained benefit scan after scan. And per protocol, it was baked into the protocol that pembrolizumab comes off after 2 years. So she hit her two-year anniversary. That came off. We actually had a long conversation about whether to continue pemetrexed, which obviously is a maintenance drug as well. For various reasons, we decided to give her a break from that as well. And now she's 4 months out, off all treatment, and with a sustained response. Still early going, but kind of presents some of the interesting questions about how to look at these chemo immunotherapy combinations.
So she was on the randomized study, correct?
She was actually on an earlier part of the study that wasn't randomized.
Oh, that's interesting. So at that point, she was on a trial using the combination that eventually, as you said, in a randomized phase 2 led to the FDA approval. I'm kind of curious now that we have the trial done, if you saw her again today, how would you manage her? And what was her TPS level?
That was the part of the study that was so early on, we actually don't know. It wasn't performed as standard of care. It was collected on trial, but not reported back to us. So, of course, I'm burning with curiosity when I present the case at case conference. It's always the first question, and one day we'll probably kind of collect that. But
so, again, maybe just think about her. You can remind me, like, what her clinical status was, whether she was symptomatic. Maybe I could ask you, if she was under 50%, over 50%, how do you think you'd approach her today?
Excellent question. So she was relatively symptomatic, good performance status, kind of one, but verging on zero. Really her main complaint, the presenting complaint that got her diagnosed was a cough that was presumably from this right hilar mass and obstruction associated with that, but very functional and otherwise not too symptomatic. So I think it's an excellent question. It's been a long conversation with any patient starting therapy these days. I think right now, if she had a PD-L1 or TPS of over 50%, I still go with the KEYNOTE-24 data and say, pembrolizumab as a single agent has an excellent response rate, excellent chance of durability, and of course, very modest manageable toxicity. So I tend to still recommend pembro as a single agent. I think the more interesting area is that 49% and below. And I have a very long conversation for folks like this to say, carbo-pem plus or minus bev has been the standard for quite some time, that there's this randomized phase 2 trial that suggests a better response rate, a better PFS. But I also express my concern to say that what we don't know, and I think what all of us are really waiting for, is there an overall survival benefit? And I pull out the history books and I say, look, any trial of 3 chemo drugs always beat a doublet in terms of PFS and response rate, but never managed to marshal an OS response. Now, I totally admit that immunotherapy is a completely different mechanism, but before I stack my treatments and kind of use all my agents up front and not know what I'm going to next, I want to be a little circumspect. So I admit that this deficiency in the data of not knowing if there's a survival benefit compared to just PFS and response rate, and I talk it out with my patients. And I admit some of my patients kind of buy the argument that we're hoping that by sequencing, if I can get some period of time with chemo alone, maybe with bevacizumab, which I can't offer with the combination here, maybe in the next line of therapy, I can offer immunotherapy plus X, you know, immunotherapy combos, immunotherapy plus vaccine, options that may do a better job of immunotherapy use in the second line. So my long-winded way of saying it's a discussion, and I have to admit that I think changing practice on the basis of a 123-patient study gives me a little cause of pause.
You're expressing the viewpoint that our survey work suggests represents around 2/3 of investigators.
Oh, okay.
There's about 1/3 who are pretty pro the triplet, but specifically, I think, in a situation where there's not an urgent need for a response, you know, a more typical kind of situation, kind of that's the way we're seeing it. Again, what about the more symptomatic patient? You lean more towards the triplet there?
I admit that's a situation where I kind of want to throw the book at somebody and get the response I need. I think that's a really valid point. And that's where I admit my resolve wilts a little bit. I say, I want a response, and if you're going to be the one who gets an immunotherapy or chemo or both response, I need it now. And so I'm willing to kind of deploy the triplet.
You refer to the issue of maintenance therapy when the carbo is stopped. And I believe that the trial, or at least the randomized phase 2 trial, allowed you to, I guess, do what you wanted. But I'm not really sure exactly what people are doing. Theoretically, they could do what you did, which is keep both the pembro and the pem going. But I guess you could pick one also.
Yeah, I admit that's always a nice problem to have, just when we're using carbo and pemetrexed anyway, that rare patient that does make it out to a year and a half and 2 years with a beautiful response. I admit that my bias is usually to leave patients on pemetrexed if it's being well tolerated. But, you know, those are patients, as great a drug as pemetrexed is, toxicity and benefit-wise, people start accruing their peripheral edema. I sometimes see kind of creeping up of creatinine that I have to attribute to that because there aren't any other factors. So I'm very open to the idea if there's mounting toxicity to give people a pemetrexed maintenance break. But I admit that situation where I have to make a call after 2 years is pretty rare.
So I guess one more thing I'll just throw out there that I was kind of thinking about, you know, this situation, do you add in a checkpoint inhibitor to chemotherapy? And, you know, I think even if you don't see a survival benefit to the whole trial, I kind of get the feeling that docs and patients are looking for, you know, sort of a home run. I mean, maybe it's not really a home run, but a prolonged, unmaintained response. I mean, this lady's able to come off treatment, for example, and saying to yourself, the only way that's going to happen is if they get a checkpoint inhibitor. Granted, they could get it second line, but that's really the only thing that's really going to change this in a really big way. What do you think about that logic?
I think that that's a really fair point. I can argue this out of both sides of my mouth, and I have. And I think the reassuring thing is, and I'm sure this was in the minds of our regulators at the FDA, the good news is we have a fully accrued phase 3 trial with a lot more patients than 123, so we'll be able to really answer both the OS question, but also get some granularity on the subgroups. So, you know, obviously, subgroup analysis is fraught, but when we're trying to look at the PD-L1 statuses, for example, and divide up this 123 patients, if you look at the data, the response rate for the less than 1% is higher than 1 to 49, which is less than greater than 50%. So there's kind of this instability of the results that I think is born of small numbers. But again, when we have a greater number of patients, we can kind of tease out the greater than 50%. Are we really adding anything to pembro as a single agent? If we're not, I'd love to give a single agent and save my chemo for the second line. Sequence has a role here. I admit there's a bit of a to-be-continued element to this, and we're going to have phase 3 data hopefully as soon as the next few months.
And incidentally, our survey data does show for sure that when the TPS is over 50%, at least the 25 investigators we asked recently, people, they go with pembro alone in general.
Completely agree. That said, those are the investigators you polled. What I see in my second opinion clinic is that I think the uptake in the community is very high. And there's an element of just trying to get as much response rate and PFS from the beginning, the logic we talked about before. One of my colleagues kind of makes the joke, it's also kind of a set it and forget it. There's no PD-L1 selection. It's a very easy regimen to give. And even toxicity-wise, we were happy to see that, you know, there was a little bit of augmented toxicity, but it's manageable. Carbo-Pem-Pembro is a manageable regimen for the vast majority of patients. So it's a relatively easy combo to give and not to have to think too much about.
This lady, her main problem was rash.
She would have kind of a recurrent leg cellulitis back and forth. So it wasn't the traditional kind of immunotherapy rash you might expect, and not something we typically see with pemetrexed, but it's someone who never had cellulitis, who then had it 3 or 4 times requiring oral antibiotics, always resolved. But I think I have to conjecture it had something to do with the pembro or the combination. She also had recurrent conjunctivitis, which is not kind of the immune-related uveitis we think of with more concern, but again, something she never had before, incidentally hasn't had in the 4 months off therapy. So it makes me think there was some element of compound toxicity there.
That's interesting. Are there autoimmune conjunctivitises?
Not that I'm aware of. Again, I think of uveitis, which I've only seen a couple times. But again, it was something that she's had frequently on trial that I just have to chalk up to something we were doing to her.
One final question, which is the issue of stopping checkpoint therapy. Now, this lady was on a trial. I don't know how often in lung cancer, you know, you get into a situation where a patient's really doing well for, you know, beyond a year, 2 years. Have you stopped checkpoint inhibitors, and how does that go when you talk about it to the patient?
What an interesting discussion to have, again, because we really are in a data-free zone. unlike chemo, where I think keeping that brake pedal down makes sense and it's kind of been verified empirically, I think there's a case to be made mechanistically that once you've gotten your response, the T cells can do their job. And so, you know, I appreciate the fact that some of the studies are trying to say, let's stop at 1 year, stop at 2 years, but also work in the rechallenge piece to the trial as well. A lot of the trials have that opportunity to stop trial either at 2 years or with a CR, but right into the protocol that a patient has the opportunity to restart. Anecdotally, I've seen both. Certainly, patients have been happy with their response. They're scared to go off, and I completely understand that. So if they're tolerating it well, I've kind of let them stay on. Other patients who maybe have had a good response, who don't have to go off for a bad immune-related AE, but have just noticed some of the small things accruing, I've been very comfortable to have a conversation after a year or two and say, well, why don't we trial off and just do imaging on an every 2 or 3 month basis and just try to catch the recurrence. And at least once or twice, I've been able to treat at the point of recurrence and get that response back. A couple others I didn't. So I think we're in a data-free zone, and I certainly hope that we can get some more data to support these decisions going forward.
Any other studies out there that you're really excited to see, maybe things that are going to be coming out in the next couple of years?
So I know this will probably be public by the time this comes out, but I think we're all interested to see the MYSTIC trial, which we know the press release came out. This is the study that looked at people with a TPS of 25% or higher. And what we saw was that Durva plus tremelimumab, a PD-L1 and a CTLA-4 inhibitor, did not beat chemo in that patient population. And I think it just maybe gives us pause. We've been excited about combos just because we've seen such great responses in melanoma, for example, to the CTLA-4 plus PD-1. And we've seen some early phase data, especially out of Matt Hellman's group, looking at, you know, showing some really good phase one responses. But now as we look at these bigger phase three trials roll in, it'll be interesting to see how the details play out. And the fact that MYSTIC was negative, I think, was a little bit of a warning shot across the bow. And again, we have to see, was that all PFS? Was there an OS kind of difference? And again, all the devil will be in the details that we don't have as of today. But as those data come out, it'll be very interesting to see how that trial comes out, how the other PD-1 CTLA-4 combinations come out as well. It's nice to know there are different companies with different agents looking at this. So we have a couple shots on goal to replicate these data or see how they differ.
Obviously, there's been a lot of attention to that initial press release or data release. And I guess the question is, I mean, it's one thing if the combination doesn't do anything, but is this in some way suggesting that durvalumab did not provide the same kind of outcomes that, for example, you see with Pembro? Of course, that was seen with the Nevo in the first line situation also.
And that's a really good point. And again, we talked before that I have fairly good equipoise among the three drugs that are approved in lung cancer in the second line, but they are different drugs. And besides that, the biomarkers are very different. The PD-L1 status does not equal PD-L1 status antibody to antibody. And I think that's going to become an important thing to really suss out as well. But I think you make a good point that A, durvalumab may just be a different drug. Secondly, tremelimumab is certainly a different drug. Even in the trials of nivolumab and ipilimumab, we see a lot of differences in the subgroups, even by dose of ipi and dose of nevo. So it's not quite as straightforward, I think. And some of the, again, the devil will be in the details about the dosing schedules and the drugs themselves, along with the biomarkers. So there's a lot of variables at play that, you know, we haven't had to reckon with as single agents, but as we look at combos, it may become more important.
Trying to summarize some of the input I've gotten from investigators over the last year or so, it sounds like the combination of anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 with anti-CTLA-4 and just non-small cell is not necessarily at this point that overwhelmingly excited. I don't hear people talking about doing it off study, but I hear a different story with small cell. So is that kind of your take?
It is, but maybe that's more a function of small cell having so many fewer options. Certainly, we're excited about some targeted therapies like Rova-T coming to the fore, but when your best bet is platinum etoposide that we've been using for 20 years and a second-line agent, topotecan, that I don't know anyone who gives on a regular basis, I think the threshold for calling an interesting development is much lower. And I think that's reflected in the NCCN guidelines as well.
So specifically, how do you use checkpoint inhibitors, if you do, outside of trial setting in small cell?
In small cell, it depends on the patient in front of me. I'm always wary of the toxicities in these patients who are generally sicker even than our non-small cell. So nivo-ipi, nivolumab, ipilimumab, is not to be trifled with. There's real toxicity. And, you know, we've seen some limbic dysregulation that's really devastating. That said, if I have a very fit small cell patient and I've used up my first line of chemo, I will have a conversation and I'm willing to offer Nivo/Ipi just because it's, again, because it's on the NCCN, I can get access to it. I always prefer a trial, of course, but these patients are, it's harder to let them travel. It's harder to accrue trials. I'm willing to try Nivo/Ipi in those folks, and I've had some limited success with it.
And are you willing to try it in non-small cell?
I'm not. A, I don't think that the data set, again, there are enough competing alternatives in that setting. And secondly, it's not on the guidelines, it's not insurance approved, and I would be reluctant to do it off trial. I think there's some kind of hints of benefit. Again, they have a phase 3 trial that's accrued that we'll see results out of soon. So, you know, I think it's a stay tuned kind of situation. I know there were some cases of fatal encephalopathy seen, particularly in the small cell patients. So that gives me pause. When you see grade 5 toxicity with a Nivo/Ipi combination, again, in a small number, but maybe more than we expect from non-small cell, it gives me pause. I talk about it with my patients, and certainly I'm looking out for that.
So encephalopathy, I'm not sure I've heard about that with checkpoint inhibitors.
In the small cell trials of Nivo and Nivo plus Ipi, there were a couple cases of fatal encephalopathy.
Wow.
That give us pause.
Hmm.
And maybe there's something more, you know, we see more paraneoplastic syndromes with small cells. So there may be something at play there.
Oh, that's true.
We might expect some excess toxicity.
Yeah, actually, I was thinking to myself, what happens if you give a checkpoint inhibitor to somebody with a paraneoplastic syndrome?
I think that's a really good question. I haven't done it yet, but I think that's a really fair question in terms of small cell is a disease, you know, where you have a paraneoplastic syndrome that's already engaged the immune system somehow. You got to give that healthy respect.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you don't have an anti-tumor effect, but you do have an anti-immune effect, that maybe is not going to be too good.
Exactly, exactly.
So let's get into targeted therapy a little bit and start out with your 77-year-old woman.
Yeah. So she had a really interesting presentation, a 77-year-old lifelong non-smoker, urology nurse, actually. Her presentation was actually acute right eye blurriness. So goes to her optometrist, gets referred to ophthalmology, and they find a choroidal met. And they did staging at that point. There was a large left lower lobe mass, some supraclavicular lymphadenopathy, osseous mets. At initial presentation, and this was a few years ago, we got ALK FISH, which was actually negative, and EGFR and ROS1 were negative. So we actually started carboplatin and pemetrexed, but as we often do when our first quick pass of mutations are negative, we sent for next generation sequencing, which, you know, takes another 3 or 4 weeks. And so while she was on carbopemetrexed, our NGS panel actually showed an EML4 ALK rearrangement. So interesting that it was not caught on FISH, but we did see it on NGS. She was having a great benefit from the chemo, so we decided to play it out. We said, let's, you know, we had already seen our first restaging. She was tolerating it well, so we actually left her on. She got a full 6 cycles of carbopem, actually got maintenance pemetrexed for 16 full cycles, and then finally progressed. And now, hey, we had crizotinib in our back pocket and gave her that, and she
Hold
had-
on, before you continue with the case, because there's so many interesting things about it. Obviously, the testing issue, I mean, I've heard stories like this before, and, you know, we try to publicize them. I think I've heard this with EGFR also, where your standard one-off test negative, you pick it up on NGS, and patient has a response to targeted therapy. I mean, there's really a story there. Did this patient have IHC?
She did not. We weren't doing that at the time on a routine basis. You know, again, this idea that IHC is a great diagnostic and may even be superior to ALK FISH. There was a nice paper in CCR just this month that suggested for FNA and small biopsies, ALK IHC outperforms ALK FISH. So, and the nice thing is it uses less tissue. So when you're trying to be parsimonious anyway with very limited tissue, I think it's a fantastic alternative.
Obviously, here you have a situation that was FISH negative, NGS positive. What about IHC negative versus NGS? What about FISH versus IHC? Are you still primarily using FISH?
Well, FISH is still our first pass. So in our shop, what we do is we kind of do a rapid assay to get us EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF right out the gate, because that's something I'm going to act on in the short term. PD-L1 as well, of course, to help decide on first-line therapy. If those are pan-negative, or PD-L1 is under 50%, then I go ahead and start my standard chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab as appropriate, but then I take the time to send for the next generation sequencing. hoping, A, maybe to find actionable mutations that are kind of on the second tier, things that I might be able to reach for off-label targeted therapies or clinical trials for, but also, as this case exemplifies, to kind of check our work. As we see, there's not total overlap or concordance, and occasionally we do pick up some EGFR, ALK, or ROS1 alterations on the NGS that weren't readily accessible on the rapid point mutation assays or FISH.
I'm also curious about the choroidal MET. Did you actually look at it yourself?
I'll admit I didn't. I'm not a very good internist anymore, I'm afraid. So I looked at the beautiful pictures my ophthalmologist put in the medical record for me. It really was impressive, but I admit I did not pull out my scope.
I was just kind of curious, did it get better? Did the ophthalmologist say it got better?
Completely. It actually, there was basically a CR by his assessment. It was remarkable.
And that was
I should clarify,
chemo.
For the carbopemetrexid, there was a nice reduction and her vision actually went back to normal. Didn't quite resolve on serial ophthalmologic exams, but on crizotinib, there was actually a clinical CR. The ophthalmologist said, I don't see it anymore. It was really kind of a neat case that way.
Except probably, did she have any of the visual things that you see with crizotinib, incidentally?
You know, that's actually, I don't know off the top of my head, but I always warn patients about the little floaters on the peripheral vision, and I don't remember if she had them or not.
I just wonder if she was going to the ophthalmologist anyhow, if he picked up on that, because I'm always curious about what that is and why people have it. But in any event, the other thing that this case brings up that we've kind of heard whiffs of over the years is the particular sensitivity to pemetrexed to ALK disease. Is that really a reality? I mean, this lady did great with pemetrexed and carbo.
Yeah, I know. Ever since Colorado published those data, I have to say, in my practice, these are my long-term pemetrexed responders. It's really kind of gratifying. And so, again, I think there's some conjecture. There's some TS, thymidylate synthetase differences in ALK patients. I don't know mechanistically why that would be, but I definitely clinically have seen these really nice pemetrexed maintenance responses. And that's why I felt comfortable leaving her on chemo, saying, I have an ALK inhibitor in my back pocket. You're tolerating it well. Let's ride this wave to its completion.
Right. So she does really well on the chemotherapy, and then she has disease progression. You put her on crizotinib. She has a great response to the crizotinib. Any tolerability issues at all with the crizotinib?
She tolerated beautifully. Actually, you know, a lot of patients do have at least some mild GI symptoms that we wind up having to manage more often in the first couple months or so, but she actually tolerated it beautifully. She went back to the gym, even as a 77-year-old, really a fit and a patient who did very well on crizotinib.
So, you know, I've been trying to figure out, our whole group trying to figure out what the current algorithm is for management of non-small cell, very biomarker-driven, and how, particularly how TPS is fitting in. And you mentioned something that we saw and we have been seeing, which is, what do you need to rule out to start initial therapy? And your list was EGFR, ALK, ROS1, and BRAF. And I would say my list, based on what I'm hearing from investigators, would include MET exon 14, although I know there's not an FDA indication. But do you consider, maybe you can just comment a little bit about exon 14 and whether you can, what kind of what I'm starting to get the feeling for is there are like four or five of these alterations that a lot of investigators will treat first line with targeted therapy, so you really need to know it up front. And then there's others, it seems maybe HER2 and RET, that maybe aren't that critical to get up front. Is that kind of globally? And where does MET exon 14 fit in?
It's interesting how we kind of see, I almost see it as people who are at bat, people who are on deck. And NCCN has that nice page that looks at the, I think they call it the emerging targets, which I think is very useful. Useful for thinking about it, also useful for insurance authorization, to be honest. I show them that page, and at least in my California practice, I always get approval for those targeted agents, even though they're off-label. I admit, you know, I think that it's hard to say when something should get promoted to first line. BRAF, as soon as it got the FDA label, I kind of made that a first line choice. I had done one or two off label before that and got it approved. Again, the MET exon 14 data are fantastic for crizotinib. I think my concern is a kind of insurance approvability. I know I can get it in the second line. And I think across all these targetable mutations, I think we've always seen that chemo followed by the targeted agent or vice versa generally has the same overall survival. So I think it's reasonable to wait for the second line and not kind of spend the time with an appeal and a peer-to-peer to get the approval. Say, I'm going to get it second line. And oh, by the way, if I get a year out of chemo, maybe it bubbles up to FDA approval or there's a trial of an even better MET inhibitor that's purposefully designed. So that's kind of how I think about it. But I agree with you that the four on top, EGFR, ALK, ROS1, BRAF, I do want that MET, RET, HER2, and the others, but I'm willing to let that be my second tier that I get as I've started chemo. If I can make one other interjection, this comes up a lot in second opinion practice, and also just because of the timing of the results. PD-L1 is IHC, so it comes back quickly, often before even the targeted mutations come back, and certainly before NGS comes back. So what I've noticed, and I certainly heard colleagues mention, maybe your panel has noticed, it seems that especially ALK patients often have a high TPS. It's really interesting. And of course, when that comes back first, I think everyone rejoices. They want to get started on pembrolizumab. But if you have this phenotype of a non-smoker, young patient, you haven't gotten EGFR and ALK back, it's not the patient who, so to speak, ought to have a high TPS, you know, the smoker, the inflamed tumor. And I think the results have been pretty consistent that ALK and EGFR underperform in the second line other patients on PD-1 inhibitors, even TPS for TPS level. And in the first line trials, of course, EGFR and ALK were excluded. So I think it's really important, as excited as we are to get that PD-L1 result back and to get started on treatment, if I'm looking at a patient in front of me that I have a high pretest probability of EGFR or ALK or ROS1, I wait for that mutation result, because I think that for some mechanistic reason that none of us truly understand, that high PD-L1 happens and it doesn't really reflect or predict for a better PD-1 inhibitor response.
And again, I've heard that consistently, and you know, this reluctance or delay in using checkpoint inhibitors in patients with driver mutations. And again, it kind of seems like the cancers that tend to be treated up front are the ones that people are pulling back from the most. So EGFR, ALK, et cetera, and i.e. that when they do progress on targeted therapy, I'm hearing a lot of investigators saying, even if they have a high TPS, like, as you say, for some reason, sometimes these ALK patients have it, we're not giving a checkpoint inhibitor with chemo at the beginning, maybe later, but not that early. Is that the way you're doing it?
Exactly. Exactly. Because again, as we talked about, let's say an ALK patient has high PD-L1. First of all, we've got great agents. We'll talk about alectinib and some of the great data coming there. Chemo is going to serve them well too. We talk about pemetrexed maintenance. I have great options in my pocket, and as exciting and sexy as immunotherapy is, my expectation of response rate and duration of benefit is shorter for these patients. So I'd rather give them these better agents up front. But it's interesting in this milieu where patients are hearing about immunotherapy on the TV, that's what they reach for, even though I can say, actually, I've got this drug in my pocket that I think will work better, longer, more safely right up front.
So this lady gets on crizotinib. She does great on it. Then what?
So interestingly, she progressed after 15 months, and she literally progressed the month that alectinib came on the market for crizotinib failure. So her timing was impeccable. She went on alectinib, which she tolerated also quite well, had about 10 months of disease response and really good quality of life. And then on restaging scans, actually had development of bilateral adnexal masses, kind of an unusual site of metastasis, and nowhere else. So odd enough, you know, whenever there's kind of an oligometastatic situation, I'm always kind of interested in making sure and actually offering a local therapy. We wound up sending her to our gyn-onc colleagues, and they did elect to resect those masses, which did reveal ALK-positive metastatic lung adenocarcinoma. But unfortunately, about a month later, she had much more widespread abdominal progression, as well as some lymph nodes growing in the chest. So the really had realized that alectinib had come to its end, and it was time to move on to the next line of therapy.
That's really interesting, though, about the adnexal mets. That's unusual. So what happened next, and where's this lady now?
Right. So I think we're in this interesting time where we know there are so many ALK inhibitors on deck. This progression happened shortly before brigatinib was approved, which is, I think, a reasonable agent to use, but we kind of felt like there was bulky enough disease. We wanted a response. We knew she was chemosensitive. We did decide to start chemotherapy, but pending, what I'm doing is actually sending that adnexal mass pathology to see if we can identify any ALK resistance mutations. Now, I know this hasn't kind of broken through to standard of care, but as we think about sequencing the ALK inhibitors, and when I need a response, I kind of almost want to make sure that one of the resistance mechanisms is addressed by, say, brigatinib, or in the future, maybe lorlatinib. But I'm actually hoping that I can get a chemo response and give me time to choose the next line of therapy. But I think this idea is interesting, where right now, alectinib first line, on progression on alectinib, there are other drugs on the market, but can we actually do precision medicine to figure out which of these bevy of ALK inhibitors is right? One of our colleagues calls it a Sanford guide. You know, from a residency, you use the Sanford guide for antimicrobial resistance. You kind of look down the chart, look across, and choose your agent. I think we can all envision a day when you do a repeat biopsy or even liquid biopsy, figure out how ALK has morphed, and choose the drug on the list that hits that best. Lorlatinib hits G1202R, which is kind of the dominant resistance mechanism, but there are many others, and so maybe actually purposefully choosing drugs is appropriate. For her, I think the science is too far ahead of her, so I did choose to do chemo next, but I am kind of profiling that tumor and seeing if it might inform which ALK TKI I use next.
That's really fascinating. We're going to talk in a second about plasma testing with EGFR. What about plasma testing with ALK and these resistance mechanisms?
Yeah, it's coming along. You know, I think that it's just amazing how quickly this technology has progressed. I still have not been as impressed by the fidelity of ALK catches on the liquid biopsies. So I think month by month, we're seeing better results. I still prefer for my ALK patients, for the rearrangement patients, I should say, both ALK and ROS, I still prefer tissue biopsy, but I am seeing some of the panels come through with concordant ALK initial mutations and ALK resistance mutations. So it's kind of exciting.
So, of course, we saw the ALEX data at ASCO. Seems like alectinib should be on its way towards being standard first-line therapy. Is that your take?
No question. And I would fight for it. I know it's not FDA approved yet, but the size of that benefit, the tolerability, and above all, the CNS control is really so compelling that I don't think it's appropriate to start someone on anything other than alectinib at this point.
But then, as you say, the question is, what's going to be next? And of course, there's a lot of variables. You mentioned resistance, maybe brain mets, but I mean, just globally, what do we know about responses? Brigatinib, at least it's new. Do you see responses, for example, have they been reported to, say, patients who had either alectinib or crizotinib? Do you see responses to brigatinib?
That's a really good question. I think the breadth of data that got brigatinib approved really was just in the crizotinib failure initial line of therapy. And I think we hear anecdotes of folks getting responses even after subsequent TKI progression. I think the more compelling data really are coming from lorlatinib. And it was so exciting to see a response rate after one TKI, two TKIs, even three TKIs. And still, after three TKIs, lorlatinib has, I think, it was a 30-40% response rate. I'm not sure brigatinib has been able to show us that second, third, fourth line data. So that's why I was a little circumspect in this patient. Maybe I don't want to throw that at her now. I need a response because she has bulky disease. But in the future, again, if I can be guided by resistance mutations or by data on the ASCO screen that shows me progression in unselected patients after three or four lines, then I'm more convinced.
What about ceritinib? I mean, it's another, you know, potent agent. Can you describe a situation where you might use it? Would you use that after alectinib? Can you describe a situation where you use the drug?
Right. I mean, ceritinib has a role. I think, you know, it's always a drug development game. They were first to the field, but unfortunately hadn't kind of refined their way of giving it. So it was a toxic drug to give at full dose at 450 milligrams. I think it actually is very tolerable. We've had a couple patients on it. Again, it's one that I would reach for. Even in this woman, I think after failure of alectinib, it wouldn't be unreasonable. I don't think we have data to say brigatinib or ceritinib would be the right next choice. But again, what I'm looking for, I hope over time, is this kind of idea that I can look for the actual resistance mutation and act on it. I admit that all those graphs we see on the screen are still mostly preclinical in nature and not patients who have this mutation who get this response rate in a human. But I think it's the route we have to take, just the way we did with T790M and EGFR. But I think there's going to be more multiplicity of resistance mechanisms and certainly more drugs to offer. But ceritinib still plays a role. And I think I'd still would put it well after alectinib at this point.
So let's finish out and talk about your 74-year-old man.
Right. So I had this 74-year-old gentleman, a lifelong non-smoker. He presented with a large right upper lobe mass and extensive bilateral pulmonary nodules. And so he was actually symptomatic because of cough and some mild chest pain. It turned out on screening, he had 26 subcentimeter brain metastases, completely asymptomatic, but really an impressive presentation. So we sent him to our radiation group, and I expected them to offer him whole brain radiation as we did the workup for his mets. They actually, and this is way off the reservation, I admit, but our Gamma Knife group is fairly aggressive, and I think because of the very tiny size of the brain mets, they did wind up offering him Gamma Knife, which he tolerated quite well, so stereotactic radiosurgery.
So I'm just trying to think about doing, so if you do that on 26 lesions, that's a lot different than whole brain?
That's a really good question. They really were tiny. To be honest, I think that there was a little bit of a delay to his mutation analysis. And I think, you know, this is a couple of years ago. I think now I would have felt more comfortable in this asymptomatic patient if I knew he had an EGFR mutation and these almost miliary but multifocal brain mets. I would have let him get the EGFR TKI for a period of time, maybe just 4 weeks or 6 weeks, again, assuming asymptomatic brain mets, because we see such a nice brain response. So I admit that I think I might have handled that a little differently if I had seen him before the radiation docs had seen him, to be honest. So I definitely want to stress, a gamma knife to 26 lesions, not standard of care, shouldn't be standard of care, but he actually tolerated it beautifully.
Wow, interesting. So this paradigm, and the key, I think, from what we've heard, is what you mentioned, asymptomatic. So no symptoms in the brain or related to the brain mets, particularly, as you say, with smaller lesions. So a lot of people, the majority, will do what you just said, systemic EGFR TKI.
Especially in this case where, again, the gamma knife was exceptional. This is a patient who, by all rights, probably should have seen whole brain radiation, or that would have been the traditional recommendation, and still would be for the non-mutated patient. So I think we are so loath to give whole brain because of that potential for longer-term cognitive dysfunction that when we have a CNS-active drug, we will go to great lengths to try to forestall the whole brain. And again, in this case, I think we probably could have. And I mean, we did, fortunately, but again, it was kind of an odd progression of events.
So this paradigm, though, of using targeted therapy in people with asymptomatic brain mets, I've heard people talk about freely in patients with EGFR and ALK, but what about ROS1? What about BRAF? What about MET exon 14? Again, small lesions, asymptomatic. Are you going to try targeted therapy?
I think it really depends on the patient. I think when we're talking about one or two lesions that are asymptomatic, we have the luxury of time and follow-up, and we can really see if these targeted therapies work straight out of the gate. And if not, then we have the opportunity to use our stereotactic radiosurgery. But I think, yeah, for all the ones you mentioned, though, that's a very reasonable approach. Somewhat depends on symptoms and size, but I give, you know, for example, some of these targeted therapy trials have been bold enough to allow untreated asymptomatic brain mets on trial, Alex included. So they get a lot of credit for proving that that's a very reasonable treatment paradigm.
Would you consider the same paradigm if you were, let's say, using a checkpoint inhibitor first line in somebody with TPS over 50%? Again, asymptomatic?
That's a vexing question. And I think that we just don't have enough CNS data at this point for the checkpoint inhibitors that I would be willing to wait. It's a conversation. And I think for the motivated patient who I trust I can do follow-up, we could think about it. I know there's some early data out of that Yale study that says there's a modest response rate in untreated brain mets, and that's across a melanoma and a lung population. But that starts making me a little bit more nervous. But if it helps me forestall whole brain, if it lets me do stereotactic to a small number of lesions, it may be a reasonable strategy. But I admit that for the checkpoint inhibitors, I haven't been as willing to do that.
So this patient, in addition to the brain mets, as you mentioned, had a lot of disease inside the chest. The patient had an exon 19 deletion. I see that you decided to use erlotinib. Just a simple, basic question. Why erlotinib as opposed to afatinib, and for that matter, gefitinib?
Right. You know, so it's certainly something we discuss all the time, especially for this gentleman who's a 74-year-old. I'm even more mindful of the toxicity profile differences between the drugs. Afatinib clearly has a bit of PFS benefit. We still really haven't seen an OS benefit. And so it's a conversation I have. And I offered him afatinib and talked about the data we have before us. But I think for most of my patients, I'm kind of leaning them toward erlotinib. Gefitinib I also haven't really been too enthusiastic about. Since we've used erlotinib so much and my staff are very facile with it, I think we feel very comfortable in our ability to pull back on dose and manage toxicity, even in our kind of older or frailer patients, that I don't feel the need to reach for gefitinib first line, though it's not a very reasonable option, of course. But again, I just haven't found many patients who find the PFS benefit palatable enough to justify the additional toxicity.
So it looks like this patient did really well in erlotinib. What happened with the tumor?
22 months, so really better than the median, really did quite well. Very nice lung and mediastinal response. But then after 22 months, he did have progression. We biopsied a subcarotid node that had grown. This was kind of before liquid biopsy was as widely available. I would be very comfortable at this point offering a liquid biopsy. But we did do a biopsy that revealed a T790M resistance mutation.
Incidentally, how did he do on the erlotinib for the 22 months tolerability-wise?
Kind of as you'd expect, a mild rash, worse in the first month that we managed, but then very mild and tolerable thereafter. He actually didn't have any diarrhea, which was nice to see. Really tolerated it quite well and never actually had to have a dose reduction.
So I'm kind of curious. I'll make a couple statements. Tell me if you agree or not. I think you're going to agree that in a situation of a patient progressing when an EGFR TKI, regardless of whether they responded or not, although maybe I'd be curious to know what you think about somebody who progresses right through it. But in general, T790 testing, standard of care?
Completely.
What about the rare patient?
I should say that my practice now, that I maybe we're going to get to this later, I generally, when patients have a fairly indolent progression, which is often the T790M clinical pattern, my approach has generally been to offer the liquid biopsy and schedule the patient back in 2 weeks, because I usually have a response, almost certainly a response by then. If it's negative, then at that point I schedule a biopsy if it's at all feasible. I think that it's a situation where we can trust a positive liquid biopsy result, but a negative result, especially when we don't even have the EGFR initial mutation seen on the liquid biopsy, kind of meaning the uptake wasn't good enough, I really think this patient would warrant a physical biopsy as well. For patients who are progressing a little faster, it doesn't mean it isn't T790M, but then I kind of move with a little more speed. So I might do the liquid biopsy and schedule the biopsy in the same week, two shots on goal. Within a week or two, I have both results back, and I don't run into the issue of discordance or negative results in a patient who needs to change therapy more rapidly.
In a patient who's clinically stable, you see any rationale for looking for T790 earlier? I'm not even sure what data we have about when T790 occurs and how long is it from the time you can detect it to the time you have clinical progression. What about that sort of preclinical progression space?
I think it's fascinating because we know that this evolution is part of what we're addressing. But I think in the actual clinical practice, I really would push against the idea of checking T790M on a regular basis. I really wait for some kind of clinical progression. Now, of course, we'll talk about the adoption of osimertinib maybe in the first line, and so that'll change the whole scope of things. But I think the core of the science is fascinating, and maybe we will come to a day when the moment we detect T790M in blood, that's the time to start. I know that there's kind of interesting study design looking at that. Really interesting idea of doing serial liquid biopsies and basically the patient having one arm have patients switch to osimertinib at the point of T790M detection in the blood, even short of radiographic progression, versus only doing it at radiographic presentation. And I think it's a fascinating idea. But for now, I'm not looking for T790M until there's a clinical progression event.
Although maybe by the time most people watch or hear this interview, it's all going to be, as you said, sort of a moot point because we're about to see the result of the FLORO trial looking at osimertinib first line. Preliminary suggestion is it was, quote, positive. So we'll see what happened. But what happened with this patient was really incredible. Maybe we can talk about it.
Right. So given the T790M resistance mutation, we went ahead and started osimertinib as a standard of care. Again, tolerated it very nicely, had a very nice reduction on the very first scan, and had several months of benefit. And then what happened?
Could I just ask, I'm just kind of curious before you go further, you said he tolerated it well. I'm curious, as you were seeing him in clinic, how was his quality of life like when the osimertinib compared to erlotinib?
It was a little better. He noticed a clear benefit in terms of energy. He had had a little bit of drop-off of energy with his progression event, but when he was a couple months into osimertinib with a nice response, he could say, I haven't felt this good since before I was diagnosed. So it was really gratifying. Very sold on osimertinib, I can tell you that.
Then what happened next is really fascinating after...
Right. So it's interesting. He was an avid hiker, avid tennis player, and he noticed that he had this very subtle weakness, something that I would have never detected on exam, but he was a little slower catching his serves. He would actually have a lot of discomfort climbing down a hill. And so he was actually referred to a neurologist by his primary doc. The neurologist did detect some loss of vibratory sense, very subtle findings, but said, you know, we know your history of brain mets. We know you have lung cancer. Gubens, should we do a more comprehensive study? So he said, let's get an MRI of the spine. Lo and behold, despite hiking and playing tennis, but with these subtle findings, had intradural disease and some leptomeningeal deposits, which were very concerning. We actually did an LP, and an LP revealed positive cytology.
Wow.
So here's a gentleman who has been on erlotinib for 22 months, osimertinib for 14 months, and he has leptomeningeal disease, but he's not that sick as stink patient that we kind of think of, you know, that diagnosis that strikes fears in our hearts. Here's a guy who is fully functional, more physically active than I am, and yet he had clear neurologic deficits by a neurologist exam and radiographic findings. And so that was right after the Bloom data had come out at ASCO last year, 2016, which had shown that osimertinib at 80 and at 160 had actually really nice leptomeningeal benefits. So we said, let's try to get the double dose. And with that double dose on his subsequent MRI, he had slight reduction in those deposits we had seen on the first MRI, and some of the symptoms he reported had improved. So I totally grant his leptomeningeal presentation is way off the map. This was indolent, which we certainly don't associate that adjective with leptomeningeal disease, but he had a clinical benefit with this double dosing.
What do we know? You mentioned the Bloom study, but what do we know in general at this point about osimertinib in CNS disease, particularly compared to erlotinib, afatinib?
Certainly has great intraparenchymal benefit. We're seeing really nice brain benefit at regular dose. You know, I think over the years we've kind of toyed around with different applications of erlotinib, which has good penetration but not great penetration. You talk about pulsatile dosing and the like. But osimertinib at full dose has had really nice CNS response rates, so that's very gratifying. The leptomeningeal piece, I think, was really inspired on the part of the drug developer to say, we're confident enough in our CSF penetration. Let's actually prospectively study some of these very potentially sick patients. And again, small study size, I think it was in the order of 30, 35 patients. But of the patients who got this osimertinib for new diagnosis of leptomeningeal disease, a majority of those folks who got to that 12-week scan, which already is a good time frame for leptomeningeal, were seeing radiographic and clinical benefit.
You mentioned earlier when we were talking about small cell Rova-T.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just take a minute and explain, because there are not too many antibody drug conjugates out there right now in clinical oncology, and I'm curious, what is Rova-T and what we know about it?
Yeah, so delta-like ligand 3, DLL3, has been identified as overexpressed on a lot of neuroendocrine tumors, especially small cell lung cancer. And some really nifty work of synthesizing basically an antibody to the DLL3 and yoking it to a toxic payload, an ADC, has resulted in some really nice response rates and with a gradient of benefit where people whose small cell lung cancer has high DLL3, better response rate, better durability. So this really neat drug development has really gone nice and quickly for a patient population who has had, again, really nothing since platinum doublet for the last 20 years. And I think it's really gratifying to see this design happening so fast. And I know there are concurrent trials in the first line, in the second line setting, and hoping for registration in the near future. Really exciting stuff.
Have you yourself used the drug in a trial?
I have not used it in a small cell patient. We actually at our center have a separate trial, again, looking at the rest of the neuroendocrine tumors. So they're small cell, of course, that are very high grade, high DLL3 expressors, but the company appropriately is looking at other swaths of the population. So looking at folks who have, say, atypical carcinoid or a large cell neuroendocrine tumor of the lung, things that, again, don't have great options, but this is at least promising. But very early, I don't think that we have really any data reported out for that yet.